Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host
Niñas Bien Podcast. We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
By the mid-17th century, we have several journals and diaries written by gentlewomen about the tumults of the time. But for the mid-16th century, such voices of women are harder to find. And yet, they lived through their own upheaval, as the old ways were effaced in preference for the new. Today's guest has, in her sparkling new novel, imagined herself into the story of a gentlewoman living in the 1540s, writing her Book of Days. It is a spellbinding evocation of Tudor England, a meditation on a lost time. My guest is Francesca Kay. She has written three previous books. Her first, An Equal Stillness, won the Orange Award for New Writers. Her second, The Translation of the Bones, was longlisted for the 2012 Women's Prize for Fiction. Her latest novel is called The Book of Days. Francesca, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really lovely to be with you, Susanna.
I want to start by saying that I loved your book. I found it such a beautiful, meditative read, and it made me really feel that I was back in the mind of this Tudor gentlewoman. And I wanted to ask you first how you found your way into her voice and how you would describe her.
What a beautiful question. With any character in a novel, I think it takes a very long time to feel oneself into their voices, to become sufficiently within the skin of the character for the character themselves to have their own internal logic, as it were, to do what only she would do, not that I would think that she would do. I often think that the process is a little bit like the old-fashioned process of developing photographs. You know, at first, there was just a very blurry image. And then as the photograph itself spends longer in the solution, eventually the details, the delineation becomes clear. And for the narrator of my novel, it did take a long time really to understand her and her voice. I think I must have written the beginning, 50, 60 times, the first section again and again and again in longhand until I really began to see her absolutely clearly. And to feel what I felt that she would be feeling as a woman of her time in her circumstances. So I'm really, really pleased that you liked listening to her.
I did, and I actually feel rather bereft that I can't continue to listen to her, which is what you should feel when you finish a good book. But I was struck by that analogy because it almost feels like that as a reader as well, that you're gradually seeing her come into focus. We learn her name quite late into the book. And there was a point at which I realized something about her voice, which is when she says, no, that's not quite the right word. This is the right word. And so that helped me get that sense of her narrative, because we've got an illusion here, I suppose, of a journal, a book of days. And one question that came to me is that we have so few pieces of historical evidence like this from the period, journals that allow us to access a woman's interiority. And I wondered if that had been a reason that you had written it, to create what we wish we had, I suppose.
It would have been a very good reason, but it probably wasn't exactly what did occur to me at the beginning. The historical time in which she lived was probably less important to me overall than exploring her sense of belonging and her sense of loss and solitariness. Although, of course, it is very important that she is where she is, although women for centuries before and afterwards were still in that same position of isolation, dependency, and complete lack of agency. Yes, it would have been an interesting experiment, perhaps, and I did very much try to make sure that, as far as I could, the words that she uses are the words that would have been used by a person at her time. Sometimes that was quite difficult to do. I had no idea, for example, that the word petal doesn't exist in England till about 1701 or something. You'd think that petal was such a crucial word, and it's very difficult to describe flowers and roses and so on without ever using the word petal. So sometimes there are things that are anachronistic. But on the whole, as far as I could, I tried to make it true to her voice. I did read nearly contemporary women. I'm not sure there's exact contemporary women, but there are people like Marjorie Kemp or Julian of Norwich. Some idea of women's internal voices, but hers is hers alone, really. And as you rightly say, it's the illusion of a journal. She's essentially talking to herself and sometimes writing things down, but it's an internalized voice mostly.
I was struck by your choice of language. Your similes are wonderful. I noted a couple of them down: the hillsides in the drought looking like the flanks of brindled hounds, or the wind still howling like a soul in grief this morning. These are wonderful. And it made me aware that you were very careful to choose images that she would have known. And that sense of the delicacy of language was very much there as well.
Yes, well, I love it that you noticed that she sometimes searches for words. She's always trying to think, how do I think what I think? And when I know what I think, how will I say it? So she is tentative. In many ways, she's quite tentative in her life. She doesn't have a secure place in her world or any world. So she is searching and she is trying and she is testing language. But yes, we all know the sort of films, you know, which are set in Tudor times, and then suddenly you see a flash of a mobile phone. You know, one has to be very aware that she can only know what she knows. In her very limited world, she can only see what she sees. I think that that question of what people in history really did see is itself incredibly interesting. I was thinking a lot about colour while I was writing the book, about colour as it would have been perceived by ordinary people who didn't have access to jewels or illuminated manuscripts, or the brightest colours they would have seen were the colours in nature, a kingfisher, a buttercup, a very bright sunset. But nothing of the kinds of colours that we take so much for granted. So I tried to make sure that she saw only what she could have seen.
Yes, and when you describe the installation of stained glass windows and use some of those references, kingfishers and so on, to bring them to light, the colours seem to me brighter in my imagination than I think stained glass windows have ever been in my vision. So you carried it off very well. You mentioned that there's grief and there's a sense of solitude in this. In fact, a newborn child who has died pervades the novel, as it must have pervaded many women's lives in this century. And you evoke it hauntingly. What inspired you here? What did you want to convey?
Well, you know, Robert Frost famously said a poem begins with a lump in the throat. And I think that a novel begins with a lump in the throat too. Not necessarily my own, although grief did play quite a large and personal part during the writing of the novel, but not, thank God, not grief for a child or a newborn. But I think that the pervasiveness of death, until really very, very recently, is something that we have forgotten, or rather turned our backs on, would rather not think about that. But for somebody of my narrator's time, and for centuries afterwards, as I said before, death was so present that childbirth itself must have always seemed a bit like going into a really dangerous battle, out of which you might emerge if you were lucky. And if you were very lucky, you and your baby would emerge, but you could easily not. And now, thank goodness, we don't look at women about to give birth and think, oh dear, you really better say your prayers. But that sense of life being so vulnerable and fragile, and the only way that you could possibly even begin to manage that would be by thinking about the rituals that helped to console you through them, is a very large reason why I wrote the novel. Thinking about grief, that lump in the throat, and how one might live with it.
Yes, and our protagonist is forced to think about death and grief throughout the period that this novel covers. And she's made to imagine what widowhood meant for a woman in the 16th century, which was the loss of almost everything, wasn't it?
Yes, I think she probably hadn't thought her own way through this. She doesn't realise until much later on, until almost the end of the novel, that she could essentially be entirely homeless, literally thrown out by her stepdaughter and not welcomed back into her father's house. And then where would she go? You know, what would she do? It's a terrifying thought that women of all classes were so undefended. It's not just a woman in the early modern period or late medieval. I'm often haunted by Jane Austen sending letters appealing for some male relative to come and rescue her from a stay that was far too protracted, and she didn't want to be with whoever she was with in Kent for months on end, an unwelcome guest, but she couldn't leave until a man came to take her away. So yes, my protagonist has probably no idea what she would do. You will know far more than I do about Tudor wills and Tudor entail and Tudor testament, but they are incredibly complicated, and no doubt there would have been some sort of portion for her. She wouldn't have been literally starving, but many women did. She's in a very, very undefended position.
One of the great works of art that's been constructed in this book is a tomb, and in the story, an Italian sculptor, or an image maker as they call him, comes to sketch the protagonist and her husband, Master Piero. And I've just recently been looking at Holbein's preparatory sketches, and so I read your description of Master Piero at work with wonder. It felt like I had gone back in time. How did you arrive at it?
Yes, I've been looking at Holbein's sketches too, and they are absolutely a bridge into the faces of the people of the time, a window into their souls and into their faces. I imagined, out of a combination of looking at lots of different both paintings but also sculpture of the period. But it was very specifically inspired by the tomb of the Duchess of Suffolk, Alice de la Pole, in the very small village church of Ewelme, which is a village just in South Oxfordshire. I lived in that village for a couple of years when I had a one-year-old, until she was 2 and a half or something, and there was really nothing to do in that village except go for a walk every single day. And we looked at the tomb because that was the end point of our walk. And it is absolutely, completely worth seeing. It's a spectacular tomb, the most beautiful, serene effigy in white alabaster, hands clasped in prayer, and perfect, beautiful profile. She's just astonishingly beautiful. And then if you lie down on the floor, and you really have to lie down or crouch very low, you see the other side of it, which is the writhing, pain-ridden, not quite dead, almost dead body of the same woman. She still has the same perfect fingernails, which you can only see now with the aid of a torch. So it was that tomb that I very much had in mind. That's, of course, a tomb for one person. In my book, it's a rather more heavily occupied tomb, and there are examples of triple tombs and double tombs that you will all be familiar with in country churches, village churches, everywhere.
I'm going to go and see that again next time I'm nearby.
Well, if you do, Susanna, the thing that I didn't know when I was all those years ago living in the village of Ewelme, I didn't know until quite recently, after I had started writing the book, is that underneath the stone slab above the cadaver, above the corpse part, very low down, there are frescoes. They're definitely not done by a maestro of any kind. They are very much the sort of gentle, villagey painting. One is the Annunciation and the other is Mary Magdalene and John the Baptist. And they are entirely invisible. It's only now with modern photography that we know that they're there. So they must have been painted purely for the consolation of the dead body underneath and for no other reason, because nobody else can see them. And I think that that's something really magical about that, both as all these years they've been hidden, but also that sense that you could console the dead or the dying. And also, it's a wonderful metaphor for all sorts of things, that they've been there, like a hidden story.
Yes, that's really very beautiful. One of the things that really came out of this for me is the wonderful way in which you detailed what came to be called superstitions, the beliefs about St. John's Eve, for example, a night when you write, or at least your protagonist does, the veil between the worlds is cobweb thin. Can you give us a bit of a sense of some of these stories and beliefs and superstitions that you were drawing on to create this story of your own?
Well, I read as much as I could of sort of folklore and collections, and I absolutely loved these ideas that, for example, if you ate fern seed, you would be invisible on Midsummer's Eve. I loved that sense that they couldn't, especially on Midsummer's Eve, and then again on the Eve of All Souls, you know, All Hallows' Eve, which must have been a particularly terrifying time when the winter was properly beginning to get dark and you had that turning world and the sense exactly that it was cobweb thin, that you could turn a corner and see your own ghost coming out of the church. It's not just confined to that period of history. When I was a girl at my convent boarding school, everybody tried to stay up on the mid-morning of Midsummer's Day, because apparently if you looked in a mirror, you'd see the face of the man you were going to marry. It never worked. Even in the 20th century, there was still some sense of these rituals. But the things that were so much part of country life, the divination with flowers, for instance, all those different kinds of ceremonies, gathering dew on May morning, because it would have special properties, the dew, and make you beautiful. They were so much the texture of her life and life at that time.
And there's also very much a sense of the rhythms of the year. That is something you do on May Day, and that's something you do at Midsummer. And that really conveyed a powerful sense to me of how people lived. That and the impact of the weather, the rain, the heat, and the difference it made. Those two sort of rooting ideas, or the sense of patterns across the year, seemed very important in the writing of this book.
Yes, extremely important, both in reality for people at that time and for the writing of the book. It gives the book its shape. It moves very specifically through days which are as close as I could possibly make them to the actual calendar of that period, bearing in mind that the calendar of that period is pre-Gregorian, so it's slightly out of sync in terms of exactly where we would be now and what would have been flowering and so on. But that rhythm, both agricultural and seasonal, and what was in flower and what was not, what you would eat and what you would not, harvest time, all the sorts of small rituals of the countryside. I didn't know, for example, that there was a particular time when they sewed the eyelids of hawks, and they sealed the eyelids of hawks at a particular time, or a particular time when you slaughter the animals. So that rhythm is absolutely central to the whole purpose of the book, to give it its own momentum, but also her life its shape.
I want to quote a little passage. This will give the listeners an idea of the joy of reading this book, but it also connects to a very important theme, which is the period in which these events are situated. So you write, "The world is turning faster than a weather vane in a gale. What was truth one year is heresy the next, and erstwhile saints are scraped out of the prayer books. We have been buffeted by crosswinds like birds tossed in a storm, barely having any say over our direction, and no one truly knowing right from wrong." And I found this such a powerful evocation of the nightmarish uncertainty of imposed religious variation with its potentially fatal consequences. What about this time of change spoke to you?
I've always been extremely interested in this time of change. I was brought up as a Catholic. As I've said, I went to a Catholic boarding school and was therefore deeply immersed in the litanies, the ceremonies of Catholicism, and also that sense of Catholicism in that particular environment, Catholicism as being very central, very mainstream. And there were the English martyrs, Thomas More, there was all that sense of Catholic history was part of what we just took for granted growing up. I know now that it was to some extent partial, but it was a very compelling picture of history and has stayed with me. An example in the history of our country in which conscience and individual thought was absolutely impossibly compromised by authority. We can think about lots of other periods in the history of the world. East Germany is a good analogy. You know, there would have been in one person's lifetime quite possible to have three quite contradictory forms of ideology. You were not quite on pain of death then, but certainly in parts of Tudor England, yes, on pain of death, would you have to accept them? And it must have been such a rupture in the soul, the psyche of people, irrespective of the doctrinal shades of difference or who was right or who was wrong, just simply to be told that what you had been brought up to believe, or to at least to accept, to practice, most particularly, of course, praying for the dead, was not just useless, but actually dangerous. And I think how hard it must have been if, say, you had been a woman about to give birth and frightened of what might happen, to be told that you were not allowed to light the candle to whatever saint in your little tiny parish church might have been the patron saint of women in childbirth, that you couldn't pray, that having any sort of rituals, spells, incantations was forbidden. That enormous sense of loss, and loss of the visual as well, of course, later, that whole incredible upheaval against which lives had to be led and continued to be led. And in the case of the people in this novel, it's only really the men who have any sense of what's going on in the outside world. The women are in their own world, entirely having to take whatever is coming their way, having no agency over what is done, what isn't done, just like the birds in the gale. It must have been really terrifying because it wasn't a slow and steady development, properly maintained, gradual reformation of belief. It went backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And at one point, you were still allowed to light candles, and then you weren't allowed to light candles. And then Sir Thomas Becket was scraped out literally by knives out of everybody's prayer books, and then candles brought back, and then toing and froing between the more reformists and the traditionalists in the court of Henry VIII. I have been very much written about in other places, but that sense of what they actually did for individuals, ordinary individuals, not people whose names we know out of history books, is what really I wanted to explore here.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
You said the enormous change, and that was what really struck me, the enormity of the sensory change of the end of Henry VIII's reign and the sort of iconoclastic start of Edward VI. And as you mentioned, also the visual. I mean, there's huge theological questions that are being addressed, and those are touched on here. But there's a point at which I almost wanted to sort of bellow at these incredible craftsmen who are making rude screens and stained glass windows in the summer of 1546. It's sheer folly, don't do it. But they don't know what's to come. They're living in linear time as we all do. And there's that sense of impending doom if you know your history. But for them, it seems like an entirely reasonable idea that you will put in this beautiful art to worship your God. And then it also seems entirely reasonable that it shall come out. Let's talk about that visual change and how it might have been experienced.
Well, it's certainly true that they were pushing a little bit in the timing of their building the chapel. And some of the characters in the book do say this isn't maybe the right time to be putting your money into stone and buildings, and you should be putting it into grain or gold. But in those years, there'd been a certain kind of, after Thomas Cromwell died and when things had sort of calmed down a little bit from the Act of Supremacy and the dissolution of the monasteries, there might have been a sense that the old ways would continue and you could just pretty well manage to muddle on and nobody would really notice what you were doing as long as you were doing it out of sight. And in the case of the craftsmen, are all employed. It's not up to them what happens to their craft afterwards. It's the man with the money who so desperately wants his own lasting memorial. But it is really terrible that it all gets smashed up or buried. And I think that probably is one of the most lasting consequences of the English Reformation for all of us, the way in which our whole emphasis turned from the visual, and in a, not of course completely pre-literate, but where literacy was much less, especially in country places, your sense of the world outside would very much have been based on the pictures that you saw in churches, the images that you saw. Churches were covered in paintings. You know, it's now we think of their sort of austere, but there wasn't a single inch, was there, of a medieval chapel or church that wasn't covered in some sort of picture and some sort of image. And then when all that changed, what did we have instead? Instead of having, say, a picture of the doom or annunciation or the nativity, we tend to have the Ten Commandments in stern black Gothic lettering. And they are themselves so different. I mean, their commandments, and most of them are prohibitions. Thou shalt not. It's repeated again and again, not, not, not. It's very categoric and very uncompromising. And even if you weren't all that good at reading and writing, you'd still get the message, wouldn't you? Big black lettering in front of you, where you might have once seen something comforting, like the angel Gabriel. So I think it had huge benefits. What we have out of that is the King James's Bible and the Book of Common Prayer and the language of Shakespeare. And we wouldn't have had that necessarily if we had muddled on in the same sort of way as they had done 100 years before that. But we did lose the visual, and I'm not sure that in England we ever really quite got it back again.
And one thing I think you do so well in this novel is to give that sense of the range of responses to religious change. I was struck by the attractions of the wandering preacher, the enthusiasm for law-breaking, which of course is only ever more so when it's in a crowd, but also the distress caused by the new rules. One of the lines that stayed with me was that the women of this village will never own necklaces of rubies. They will only ever have their precious rosary beads, that sense of riches taken from them. Can you talk me through some of these reactions that you wanted to convey?
Well, losing their rosary beads, I think that must have been because telling the rosaries, saying the rosaries, having the rosaries, that was an important thing. Probably one of the most difficult things was not being able to have any offerings. Little altars in churches, little shrines, little places with whatever your local saint was, holy wells, places that you could go to draw some sort of inspiration or comfort, or just because people had always done so. And candles in the beginning of the proper set of injunctions after the death of Henry VIII, the only candles you could possibly burn were two candles on the rood cross, and then later on they were burned too. Lighting candles, the whole question of, you know, the guilds being responsible for candles, people raising their own little tiny amounts of money for candles, light in a world without any artificial light. Candlelight must have been in itself a marvellous thing to have, and that sense of something glowing and burning there all the time, even if you couldn't have had much candlelight in your own house and you might have just had rushes or whatever. I think losing all that, and especially also the tokens in the book, there is quite a lot about the girdle of St. Margaret. The legend is itself wonderful because St. Margaret of Antioch was swallowed up by a dragon, preferable to losing her virginity, and then essentially expelled by the dragon. And bizarrely, because she was expelled so easily by the dragon, there was a sort of parallel potentially with easy childbirth, though the analogies are not perfect. So she was this patron saint of women in childbirth. And a little scrap of her girdle in this book is the biggest treasure that the people of this small village have. Of course, I'm not entering any sense of, you know, how many bits of girdle would there have been all over Christendom. It's the same sort of well-rehearsed argument about the number of fragments of the true cross. It doesn't matter whether it was real or not. What matters is that they thought it was, and they thought that it would possibly help them, and that it was carried around in a special little case because it was so precious, and the parish priest would bring it to you and lay it upon your belly in labour. And somehow, although clearly it wouldn't have always worked, somehow it helped. And there is something sad about having to lose all those little scraps of things, those little scraps of girdles that might help you through a hard life.
You mentioned just very briefly there the death of Henry VIII. And I enjoyed the bit where you imagined the popular reactions to his death. What do you think ordinary people might have made of their late king?
Well, I was careful in the book not ever to mention that king by name, or the young king by name, or any other word that we would now use, like, say, Protestant or Reformation. Nobody ever says King Henry, because they just wouldn't. You know, the old king, the young king, the king. I think that from her quite removed and remote way of looking, my young narrator would have a certain amount of glee that this person whom she saw mainly as the reason for motherless children, a man who killed the mother of his own child. That is what she mainly feels about this monarch. As a woman who wants to be a mother so badly, that was the thing that made him so unforgivable. But I think also when we think about, for instance, the pervasiveness of the Treason Act, by word or by writing, no, by word, just saying the slightest thing against the king could land yourself possibly on the scaffold if, you know, that fear that he inspired must have been a relief, mustn't it, that he had gone and they didn't know that it was not going to be a lot easier. How would they know that the little boy that came onto the throne for in many ways would have equally devastating consequences.
The monarchs, who, as you say, go unnamed, are perhaps the only historical people in the book. The only other exception I wondered about was Henry Machin, because there was a chronicler by the same name, but I wasn't sure if that was deliberate or not. I think the ages don't quite work. And I wanted to ask you, I suppose, sometimes when I speak to people who've written novels about real people who lived, I want to ask them about the audacity of doing that, really. And I suppose, by contrast, I want to ask you about choosing people who aren't known to history, people that you have invented or communed with and are conveying to us. What underlies that choice for you as a novelist?
Well, I'm not a historian in any way, and I wouldn't want anybody to think that I was pretending to be one. I wouldn't have had the audacity to write a properly historical novel in which historical figures appeared. I greatly admire people who can do that, but that really wasn't what I was trying to do. I was trying to write about what it might have felt like to live then. So it was very, very important that they weren't people whose own lives were to some extent either chronicled by themselves in their own writings or at least in the historical record. It was utterly uninteresting to me who was at the court at the time. They had no effect on the people of this particular village. Every now and again, somebody might go to and from London, but they only report back. The younger men in the village or the younger men in the household have some connection with Lincoln's Inn. They were potentially on the fringes of it. But even they don't bring back stories of the court and who was in and who was out. That wasn't the point of it at all. The point was to feel, this is what it feels like. This is what people we are now. Because I think if, you know, history is about trying to make sense of the past and also through that perhaps to shed some light on how we think about ourselves now and about our present. I apologize if anybody hoped that they would learn any history from reading this book. I mean, it won't give you any dates or any chapter and verse of anything. At some point, somebody does say, you know, the greediest of the wolves is dead. And that's a glancing reference to Cromwell and the sense of the extraordinary exchange of money and land and gold and property that happened in the years of Cromwell and the dissolution of the monasteries. But these events happened before the time of the novel, and what goes on afterwards is also out of the scope of the novel. It's really just that year or two in the life of one small English village, and particularly through the eyes of one very observant and clear-sighted but isolated young woman.
Well, as a historian myself, I beg to differ. I think that what you do offer here is history. It may not be rooted in the injunctions of happened in so-and-so year, but it offers something much more interesting, in my view, which is a sympathetic imagination, which takes us into the period in a way that felt flawless to me. So as someone who spends my time thinking about this period a lot, I would highly recommend this to people who are interested in this period of time, because it really evokes that and the reality of ordinary people and ordinary women. I want to ask you one last question. Given that this novel has, among other threads woven through it, bereavement and religious change, can we talk a little bit more about something we've already addressed in part, which is what those changes meant for death and for how it was processed and for how people dealt with grief? It feels like there's a, I don't want to reduce your beautiful novel to a message, but it felt like there was a thought here about how, as a people, we equip or don't equip ourselves to deal with something we must all face.
Yes, that's a beautiful question, and it's a very big one. And I would only half struggle towards an answer, I think. I don't think there is an answer. But underlying the exploration of the novel is that sense that the dead are not entirely lost to us, that there's a communion between the living and the dead. I don't want to be distracted by discussing the doctrinal questions of indulgences and purgatory and the Calvinistic opposites, you know, salvation by grace, the technical questions to do with the doctrine of salvation. They're really interesting, but they're also slightly beyond the scope of this novel or any novelist. But what I feel that there really was this strong sense that by singing for the dead, by praying for the dead, by remembering the dead, by saying their names again and again and again, and if you were like the Lord of the Manor in the novel, your pockets were deep enough to have somebody to pray and sing for you every single day in the hearing of other people. There was this continuity of the living and the dead. When you quoted earlier, when the world was cobweb thin, that isn't just the cobweb thin to ghosts in a sort of modern sense of ghostly and sort of spooky. It was also that the living and the dead were not necessarily incredibly far away. You'd soon join them because you'd be dead one day. But meanwhile, you could keep them in your heart and you could keep praying for them. Losing that sense that there was anything that could be done for the ones that you had lost, I feel that that must have deepened the grief that they suffered so much, because ritual and rite remain consoling for some of us. And they were very much encouraged to do that and to do it for themselves as well, to think about what they might do for their own salvation of their souls. I'm not really sure that we've managed quite to put anything so effective in that place, because the dead now seem in a modern world to be quite lost to us. But I think that in the medieval world, they probably felt that they were just round the corner.
Well, on that lovely and moving note, we shall finish. But I highly recommend that people pick up a copy of The Book of Days, because it's an amazing evocation, as you've heard, of this period. and a very enjoyable read. Francesca Kay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Susanna. It has been lovely talking to you, and I'm so delighted that you enjoyed my book. Thank you very much.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at notjusttudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. If you'd like to know more about Henry VIII, I'm soon going to be running an online course. Just go to my website, susannalipscomb.com, and choose Courses and put your name on the waitlist so you're the first to hear about its launch.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age. A house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.